Sometimes I wouldn't see my brother, whom I loved. I wouldn't see him for 6 months at a time because he lived 10 blocks on the west side and I lived on the east side, and I never went that direction or something. I don't know. But these things, the family feeling, many, many old, ancient, and beautiful things are really destroyed by commercialism. You know, you can't believe anybody tells you that plaster cigarettes have got the best filter and a good for your lungs and so on. When you hear that on television, you know it's a lie. And you're conditioned to believe half the things you hear are lies. I know in New York, I always used to say the difference between San Francisco and New York, one of the differences was, in New York, if someone would stop you on the street and say, "Hey, bud, give me a light," or "Please give me a light," you'd figure out, what's his racket? Is he out to pick my pocket? Everybody feels that way there. You instinctively distrust everybody. Here you can ask anyone for a light, and they will give you a light and not whistle for the cops. And so this city has, it seems to me, in its own reserved, cool way, it has more of a friendly feeling than New York. And friendship is a thing we must fight for and must save. I remember in Paris hearing the cultural secretary of the Communist Party of France made a memorable speech, which was printed later in Lettre Française, in which there was a debate going on at that time. Some of the painters, some of the more progressive painters especially, were attacking the old landscape as a genre or medium in painting. They said it's dead, you know, all these. They were beginning to go into abstraction then. So the landscape, they were writing against it and sneering at it, all this great tradition of Corot and hundreds of others of painters. And Laurent Casanova, the cultural secretary, said, in this time when fascism is threatening the world, he says, when they are threatening to destroy the world, when a fascist looks upon the landscape and thinks only of where he can place the guns, where he can throw the bombs, we must fight for the ancient landscape of mankind. And that was a beautiful idea, and it fitted into socialism, it seemed to me. I remember another remark that always remained with me in the novel Clean Samdian by The Bystander, is another title, by Maxim Gorky. The central character, it's not one of Gorky's best novels, but it's a very comprehensive picture of the progress of the intelligentsia in Russia before 1905, after 1905, coming up to the Soviet Revolution. And the central character is a sort of a fellow who always has reservations. He's an intellectual, but he looks upon everything, including love. He never can wholly love a woman. He could never think of having children. And he approaches the movement in that way, something like that thing I mentioned, Edmund Wilson, who was like a high-chested, myopic society woman, getting on a streetcar and putting her nose up. I had that once happen to me, and I pushed her aside. She was sitting next to me and sniffing at me, and I finally couldn't stand it anymore. I told her, why don't you hire a taxi cab, because you're superior. But Gorky said of this character, he says, if you can't love people, you can never be a socialist. That's what Gorky says of this fellow. And I don't think you can fight this faith that hangs over us, this bomb and the war, unless you value and treasure and love the human race. You have to have a really strong feeling to go out and do something about saving not only yourself, but saving others. That'd be a wonderful thing if we could let all the war makers take half of America and fight, and let the rest of us move to the east or the west, divide the country. Let them fight all they wanted. But it's not practical. It's not practical. If they could play around with an atomic bomb and let us alone, it would be a solution to the whole thing. But unfortunately, it isn't true. So we have to treasure the landscape and friendship and art and science and all these things that make humanity what it is, that have brought us here. I just put a few notes down. What makes a radical? What makes someone like us? This has been debated very often. I know there's a big literature, Freudian literature, you know, it's one of the most comical things you can read, you know. I remember reading a book by a famous Hungarian psychoanalyst, in which he proved by all the mumbo-jumbo of his pseudoscience that the Russian Revolution was made because the people were revolting against a father complex. That was why they made the revolution. They were all neurotics, and they had an Oedipus complex, and the only way they could get rid of the father was to go after the Tsar. I mean, that was simply his simple-minded explanation. Others have said that it comes from envy. Well, it does come from some envy. Some of these, there's a section in West Virginia today where the coal miners are starving as much as they did in the 1930s in the midst of this luxury. And those people, I'm sure, are very envious of anyone who has 2 square meals a day. They are envious, and they wish they had. Envy is a very natural thing when people haven't got something. The only bad envy is the envy of people who are trying to keep up with the Joneses. Mrs. Jones gets a new sofa, and Mrs. Smith nags her husband to death till he saves up $500 for a new sofa. This is envy of the malicious kind, of the destructive kind. But the envy of masses, millions of Africans, Chinese, of Indians, of white and Negro Southerners, all these hungry places of the world, and 2/3 of mankind goes to bed hungry every night. The statisticians and the geographers of hunger have reported. So their envy makes radicals of them. Well, okay. And their hatred of people who oppress them. I know I felt a great hate of bosses in my time from personal experience. I went to work when I was 12, and I worked at physical jobs till I was about 21. I worked in factories and all kinds of jobs. I worked for the Adams Express Company. My younger boy is carrying on the great tradition. He works in a warehouse now. I think as I think back on my life, I really think the thing that made me a radical was that I really liked people. I felt I had too much of it, actually, as a youngster. Pity is a bad thing for you sometimes. And I think Jewish people have an extra amount of pity. They respond very quickly to any suffering of another people, of Negroes, Chinese. Jews are very, very warm-hearted people, in spite of the legends that have been spread about them. And pity is one of the uh, one the deepest emotions that the Jews have had knocked into them by a couple of thousand years of suffering and oppression. And so I think we can well say that hate and envy will cause people to become radicals. But if they don't retain or don't learn some love of people in their makeup, they don't remain that way. I've met people in the movement for these 40 years. Some of them were big shots and so on. And now as I look back, I realize these people didn't like anybody. And they were no good, even when they were officially good guys. Anyone that couldn't treat his secretary politely and decently, or treat ordinary people right, they couldn't be a socialist. He couldn't understand what made the whole movement tick, for example. And this is not just a sentimental thing with me, because it has a reasonable basis. For example, no movement can really go on just with a few leaders, like generals without an army. So the makeup of your army is really what makes the character of the struggle. And when you think of the millions of people that have fought in social struggle, and the inventiveness some many have shown, the courage, the ability to lead, the self-discipline, the suffering and sacrifice they've been able to make. People who came through the whole McCarthy period of persecution here. Don't you see? Each person had to make his or her own choice. They had to stick by their convictions. So this is a form of genius. This is as much a form of genius as the writing of a Thomas Mann or a Shakespeare or anyone else. It's moral genius. And in the long run, it is going to be the thing that will save the human race from war and from extinction. If this genius can be aroused in America and in other Western countries, we won't have war. They say the common people, the little man, the average man. Think of some average people who got into trouble and what they did. Think of the Rosenbergs. Two very unknown people, and you read their letters and you realize how they resisted a chance to live if they only would turn false to their convictions and to their friends. Think of Sacco and Vanzetti. I wonder how many of you saw in New York the revolt. Hippolyte Harbour was the editor. And here I went up one morning, this anarchist friend of mine, a Ukrainian, told me that they were going up there, and about 10 of us went up to Plymouth, Massachusetts, where there was a strike of 2,000 Italian cordage workers in the Plymouth cordage factory. Plymouth is where the Mayflower landed. And we went up in the trains. Galliani, the anarchist leader, a very paternal-looking man with a white goatee, and there were these other anarchists. They were wild, some of them. Some of them had guns, and it was a mishmash. But when we got up there, there was at least 400 cops waiting at the station. The papers had been full of this story. This was an anarchist strike, and they had 100 anarchists with bombs were coming from Boston. And so they were waiting for us. The whole town was waiting. I don't know. We just walked through, you know. Nobody said a word. We didn't speak to them, and they didn't speak to us. And we went to the strike headquarters, and they had a meeting on, and one of the speakers was Vanzetti. he was still a student worker in that Plymouth mill, and he was blacklisted after the strike. He became a fish peddler, and that began his story. Boston, I lived there a couple of years, worked on a paper and one thing or another, and I went back in 1927, the last week, and we got a call that they needed people to pick up the State House there, the week of the execution. And I went around, tried to rustle up some people, and some of them had some very wonderful, urgent business to do, like Rick Stout, who used to be a firebrand on our masses. He used to meet in his penthouse, but he had a terrifically important engagement, I remember. But we got up there, about 20 of us, and so the town was just half crazed with all these false reports. The anarchists were going to throw bombs and, well, just all that atmosphere of a lynching. Be like the lynching of the chessmen in a way, of the Rosenbergs. But what I was going to get at, here is the Sacramento City, two ordinary Italian immigrants, one a shoemaker and the other a peddler. What genius they showed under conditions that would have tried and crushed the soul of many an intellectual or anyone else that you can name. Yet these were simple rank and filers, Rosenbergs and Sacco and Vanzetti. I know a wonderful poet in France, Béranger, about 1830. He was truly a poet of the people. He wrote, he'd take the use of sort of a Robert Burns of France. Take these old French songs. He was a great collector of the old songs, and he'd write these beautiful, charming lyrics with great social content. Like his girl was Lisette, and she was a working class girl, and he praises her for her working class qualities. And then he writes a little song about his old coat. He has poems about stool pigeons and about dogs who hunt people and so on. Well, he, in one of his prefaces, he says to the authors, he says, and they had a lot of this beginning at the time, a sort of naturalism in which they always portrayed, whenever they portrayed the people, they portrayed drunken beasts and living in darkness and hateful, beating their wives and so on. And Béranger says to them, he says, if you are going to portray the people, why don't you do it in their great moments of genius, in their heroic hours, when they show what is inside them, what has been so long suppressed, so long frustrated. And I say we must have these qualities. I don't want to talk much more, but I just wanted to wind up. A few speakers tonight spoke about Americanism and what it really means. And you know, sometimes I think we are old-fashioned American patriots. We radicals. We are the ones that really love America and love this country and its people. The others want to exploit it. They want to use it for war. They want to this and that. And the intellectuals, who was fighting for the character of the American people during the great boom of the 1920s, when you had the voice of this middle class, really was H.L. Mencken, a brilliant satirist, but a man who despised the people. And he called the people the bourgeoisie. And he used to collect all sorts of items, you know, superstitions and foolishness of the American life. At the same time, the radicals were the one. We are a paper of the masses. We were constantly polemizing against him and defending. During the McCarthyite period, when labor was completely silent, when the youth was silent, and a handful of radicals were the only ones to carry on the democratic tradition, to defend it openly, and to suffer for it, defending it. And we were defending the character and the future of the American people. We were saying that they are not dead if they are silent, that there will be a comeback, and so on. Have to put it into effect, they are the ones you believe in. Everything that happened here tonight, I hope I can have a tape record of it. It's soothe me when I'm 95 and make me remember the time I was a young man at 66. And thank you, dear friends, dear comrades.
Bowery, working in the factory, writing of love on a garbage dump, writing mass recitations like Strike, Vanzetti in the Death House, 120 million, a young son of the American working class, of the Jewish millions cast in the east side of New York, the boy, the young man, the beginning of a writer of the American working class. From ego poet to mass poet, beginning to say things that shaped our lives.
It was 1914, I was 19, and I had been working since I was 12. My father had been sick for years. I was the main support of my family. I had tramped miles one morning into a big demonstration at Union Square. I saw a woman worker slugged to the ground. I rushed to help her and was slugged by a cop with the eyes of a killer. I bought the first copy of the new masses for a dime at that meeting. It started my education in socialism. It inspired me to write a poem on unemployment. It was my first entrance into letters. I wanted to be a witness to the wrong done to my people, the American workers.
They told me to love America, but where is America?
I saw no nation in my wanderings between the oceans.
I saw 120 million.
I saw the sun walk over the Rocky Mountains. I saw the wheat fields blaze in the plains. I saw millions of American flowers and heard the bird song of America.
It is a strong and beautiful earth, and I, a worker, loved it. But how could I love those who kill workers?
America, I cannot worship your money, God. This monster whose heart is a Ford car, whose brain is a cheap Hollywood movie.
Whose cities are mad mechanical nightmares, whose litany is a fur coat and silk stockings, whose worshippers die of nervous glut, whose victims die of hunger.
Who killed Sacklin Vanzetti?
Not you, O Mississippi River.
Who extorted the world's gold?
Not you, O Allegheny Mountains.
Who killed Germans for profits?
Not you, O American fields and forests.
It is a strong and beautiful earth.
I see the bloody birth you will bring. I see fire and ashes.
And my own land rising from the ashes.
I see peace for 120 million.
I see a hammer sun by day and a sickle moon by night.
Shining on a new America. A workers' and farmers' America.
Blonde, feared by all the workers. But my mother told him what was what. She scolded and he listened. It's because he needs me, said my mother proudly. That's why he lets me scold him. I am one of his best workers. He's afraid to fire me. She would never eat the lunch served there, but took along two cheese sandwiches. Your food is dregs, fit for pigs. She begged me never to eat hamburger when I grew up. Swear it to me, Mikey. Never, never eat it. Poison. They don't care if they poison the people so long as there's money in it. If I could write English, I'd write a letter to the newspapers. Mind your own business, my father growled. Such things are for Americans. It's their country and their hamburger steak. She stood up to the landlord, too. Our tenement was a junkie. Broken and dirty and no water for days. The neighbors were excited. Mrs. Tannenbaum exploded like a bomb. Let's get axes, we'll hack out the walls, we'll smash the windows, we'll move out. Mr. Zunes, the landlord, called for the rent and said he would fix the plumbing next week. Next week, my mother sneered. May the lice eat you next week. May your false teeth choke you to death next week. Next month, nothing had been done, and Mr. Zunes called for the rent. Everybody, including Mrs. Tannenbaum, paid the rent meekly. Everyone except my mother. She faced the landlord boldly and said in a loud voice for everyone to hear, first fix the plumbing, Mr. Zunzer, then I'll pay the rent. I'll throw you out, said Mr. Zunzer. Mischief maker. You can scare the others, my mother said coolly. But me you don't scare. I'll call the sheriff to have you thrown out. No, said my mother. First you'll have to take me to court. I know my rights. Fool you on your rights, said the landlord. I have a pull with family. My mother put her hands on her hips and asked him quietly, but with God you have a pull, Mr. Zunzer? Mr. Zunzer was startled. Don't talk to me of God. I am more of you, sinner, than I am of you. I give a dozen times more money. Everyone knows you have money, said my mother. Even the angel of death. Someday he will come for all your money, Mr. Jones. He fixed the plumbing.
Enemies have spread the slander that I once attended Harvard College. This is a lie. I worked on the garbage dump in Boston, but that's all. 200 acres of slime, mud, hills of rotting fish, mountains of cans. I felt all America had eroded and was rotting into death. People snatched like magpies at the garbage. Some of it was resold to the poorest poor. I worked on a paper failing press. I was 19 years old and in love with two women. Concha, a Portuguese girl who worked on the dump, and an aristocrat who lived on Beacon Hill. I didn't know her. I merely passed along the street going to the Armenian rooming house and heard her playing Mozart in the dust. I listened with a beautiful, confused aching in my soul. I believe in two opposing kinds of love, the physical and the spiritual. I heard a worker boast he had gone home with Concha. This, in my loneliness, inflamed me, and I wanted her too. She spoke little English. Life flamed in her full breast. She danced, joked, sang. She was full of dangerous electricity. She was the crazy young clown and melodious lark of our garbage dump. At last, she asked me to come to her house. I can never forget it. It was spring. I was 19 and on the road to my beloved. She had decorated herself for my coming, rouged her cheeks, hung pendants on her ears that she had found in the dump. My heart beat fast. She introduced me to her family. They left us alone. She came and sat in my lap. "You like me, boy?" she whispered. "You give me a dollar, maybe?" She saw the shocked look on my face, and it hurt her. "Me poor," she began to talk rapidly. "Me make $8 a week. Me papa die. Me no bad girl. Too much poor, savvy?" There was a ache wound in my heart as I gave her a dollar. I walked home heavy with a load of pain. I walked through the streets, glamorous with May and darkness and lights and sounds, and cursed. It had ended in cheapness, my proud wildcat beauty. My God, would I never escape from the garbage dump of America? I saw the other girl playing Mozart. I listened to the pure, bright flow. This was the world of spiritual beauty, music and art and ethereal love, and I, the proletarian, could never enter. I would die like a stinking old dog on a garbage heap. I grew weak and cowardly and wanted to die. Then a cop loomed up in the spring night, poked me in the ribs. "Move on, bum!" Anger boiled in me to save me from self-pity. Harsh, clean anger like the gales at sea. Everything straightened out in my head, and I came back to the strong proletarian realities. Candlelight and spiritual values, to hell with you all. You're parasites. Concha is the one who pays for you. It's more honorable to work on a garbage dump than to be a soulful parasite on Beacon Hill. If Concha needed a dollar, she had a right to ask for it. Then I dreamed of a great movement to set the working class free.
By the river, when so beautiful and just the man flesh cleaved to woman flesh, as in the world's beginning by a river.
"Oh, Georgie, Georgie," she cried, "the jazz notes moan through the trees like flights of birds lost on a river. Oh, Georgie, Georgie, I'm so lonesome in the shoe factory and not having no real friends but the river. I could die for love in this grass with the wild wet smell and my sweet daddy over me by the river. Oh, Georgie, Georgie, don't ever leave me."
But he left her, and she bears his child by the river.
And she wanders the night docks and the moors and wrings her hands by the dark river. We need to be loved. We droop like yellow dogs without love. When no one loves us, we plunge for peace into the dark river.
Oh, watchman, leave the property you are guarding and speak a word of love to the girl by the river.
Warehouses, smelling of spice and leather, open your locked doors and give her rest by the river.
Skyscrapers stoop to her. Stars tell her the world is a silver union of rivers.
Tugboats, send her a brave yellow flare from the boilers as you chug down the river. Bosses who drove her, foremen who hated her, be kind to her now.
She walks by the river.
Pimps who sought to seduce her, she has come to the river at last.
Landladies, wheels, strong bankers, old factory whistles, old congressmen, old river.
Oh, America,
oh, you who used her,
forget your money lust now. She dreams of the river.
I begged her to wait for dawn. Oh, my darling, my darling.
Revolution will rise from the east on the dark river, bringing peace to workers and peace to women, and no more dark river.
7 million are out of work in America at this moment.
On March 6th, they came out into the streets and asked for work and bread.
Cops gave the blackjacks to gas bombs instead. The liberals are having a hard time making up their minds on unemployment. The New Republic blamed the workers for the demonstration at Union Square and called it a neurotic desire for suffering.
John Brown, Tom Jefferson, and Abe Lincoln were among those present when the clubbing began. They received a severe beating and were arrested and tried. The judge said he hardly wished there was a law to hang such red. I wish I had you alone in the locked room for half an hour, he said to them. Jefferson and his comrades were heard to murmur. We would also like to be alone with you, Your Honor.
America is as full of ex-radicals as an old mattress is of bugs. At best, they become harmless writers of sex and detective stories, or cynical newspaper men, migratory bums, or businessmen. At worst, they become misleaders of labor.
Or they become those literary stool pigeons on bourgeois newspapers who make a career of exposing the radical labor movement.
Kropotkin once consoled a comrade who mourned over the baseness of such renegades. The great anarchist declared, "Let them go. We have had the best of them. We have had their youth."
What makes the liberal journalist so emotional about prohibition?
It's gin alone that lifts Mencken out of his Schopenhauerian pessimism.
It infuriates the mild and whimsical Hayward Broun so that he threatens barricades.
These great idealists who remain Olympian and coal miners are shot down by the state troopers, or Haiti is invaded by our Marines, but burst out in revolt if you take away their gin.
Don't take their gin!
There was a yellow moon over the pines. We drove through 20 miles of ragged farms on the watch for deputies. At last we came to a lonely shack in the depths of the big plantation. Here some 30 men and women were waiting, Negro farm workers to form a new branch of the International Labor Defense.
A kerosene lamp flickered. By its light, I could see the dark, silent faces of the farm workers. Outside, the workers on guard were scattered along the road. Three Negroes were in jail on a framed-up murder charge. A Negro girl had been half-beaten to death in the field.
I have never been at a meeting that touched me so. When you said the word hunger, a deep sigh came from them and mournful amen. When you spoke of freedom, the amens grew louder. Two women began to cry. I felt like crying too as I spoke. Oh, how all the centuries of slavery of our class suffering pressed in upon us. How real the sheriff's moon over the pines.
The organizer, a giant white farmer known as a Red, said to them, "You have come to hate your white bosses, but these are different whites. They come down to help free you from chattel slavery. They are your comrades. Unity of black and white for the freedom of both in the spirit of Jesus Christ."
a working man organizing an ILD branch in the name of Jesus Christ. There were subversive influences in my childhood. The public library, for instance. I read Dickens, Hugo, Twain, conspirators against profit and war. I read everything Mark Twain ever published. John Reed had a great influence on me. Walt Whitman was the greatest influence in my youth. He is a part of me. I could not stomach the hollow man.
Edmund Wilson. He ascended the proletarian bandwagon with the arrogance of a myopic, high-bosomed Beacon Hill matron entering a common streetcar.
Thornton Wilder, a genteel spirit of the new parlor Christianity, pervades his rhetoric. What lovely, what well-composed deaths and martyrdoms, what sighs, languishings, and flutterings of God's sinning doves. He has concocted the literature of all the chambermaid literary Sunday school tracts, boulevard piety, and added a dash of preschool teacher's erudition and embalmed all this in a speciously glamorous style, with a shallow clarity, smug, tight little good taste that reminds me of...